Chapter 28. It was on a soft, dark evening of the following week that they engaged in the adventure. Tina was to meet her at a point in the highway at which the lane to the village branched off. Kristoff was to go ahead of them to the harbor where the boat lay, row it round the Nother Lookout as it was called in those days, and pick them up on the other side of the promontory, which they were to reach by crossing the harbor bridge on foot and climbing over the lookout hill. As soon as her father had ascended to his room, she left the house and, bundle in hand, proceeded at a trot along the lane. At such an hour, not a soul was afoot anywhere in the village, and she reached the junction of the lane with the highway unobserved. Here she took up her position in the obscurity formed by the angle of a fence, whence she could discern everyone who approached along the turnpike road, without being herself seen. As he had not remained thus waiting for her lover longer than a minute, though from the tension of her nerves the lapse of even that short time was trying when, instead of the expected footsteps, the stagecoach could be heard descending the hill. She knew that Tina would not show himself till the road was clear, and waited impatiently for the coach to pass. Nearing the corner where she was at slackened speed, and, instead of going by as usual, drew up within a few yards of her. A passenger alighted, and she heard his voice. It was Humphrey Gould's. He had brought a friend with him, and luggage. The luggage was deposited on the grass, and the coach went on its route to the Royal Watering Place. I wonder where that young man is with the horse and trap? ..." said her former admirer to his companion. I hope we shan't have to wait here long. I told him 9:30 precisely. Have you got her present safe? Phyllis's? Oh, yes. It is in this trunk. I hope it will please her. Of course it will. What woman would not be pleased with such a handsome peace offering? Well, she deserves it. I've treated her rather badly. But as he has been in my mind these last 2 days much more than I should care to confess to everybody. Ah, well, I'll say no more about that. It cannot be that she is so bad as they make out. I am quite sure that a girl of her good wit would know better than to get entangled with any of those Hanoverian soldiers. I won't believe it of her, and there's an end on't. More words in the same strain were casually dropped as the two men waited, words which revealed to her, as by a sudden illumination, the enormity of her conduct. The conversation was at length cut off by the arrival of the man with the vehicle. The luggage was placed in it, and they mounted, and were driven on in the direction from which he had just come. Phyllis was so conscience-stricken that she was at first inclined to follow them, but a moment's reflection led her to feel that it would only be bare justice to Matthos to wait till he arrived, and explain candidly that as he had changed her mind, difficult as the struggle would be when she stood face to face with him. She bitterly reproached herself for having believed reports which represented Humphrey Gould as false to his engagement, when, from what she now heard from his own lips, she gathered that he had been living full of trust in her. But she knew well enough who had won her love. Without him her life seemed a dreary prospect, yet the more she looked at his proposal the more she feared to accept it, so wild as it was, so vague, so venturesome. As he had promised Humphrey Gould, and it was only his assumed faithlessness which had led her to treat that promise as naught. His solicitude in bringing her these gifts touched her. Her promise must be kept, and esteem must take the place of love. She would preserve her self-respect. She would stay at home, and marry him, and suffer. Phyllis had thus braced herself to an exceptional fortitude when, a few minutes later, the outline of Matthos Tina appeared behind a field gate, over which he lightly leapt as she stepped forward. There was no evading it, he pressed her to his breast. It is the first and last time. She wildly thought as she stood encircled by his arms. How Phyllis got through the terrible ordeal of that night she could never clearly recollect. She always attributed her success in carrying out her resolve to her lover's honor, for as soon as she declared to him in feeble words that as he had changed her mind, and felt that she could not, dared not, fly with him, he forbore to urge her, grieved as he was at her decision. Unscrupulous pressure on his part, seeing how romantically as he had become attached to him, would no doubt have turned the balance in his favor. But he did nothing to tempt her unduly or unfairly. On her side, fearing for his safety, she begged him to remain. This, he declared, could not be. I cannot break faith with my friend, apostrophe said he. Had he stood alone he would have abandoned his plan. But Christoph, with the boat and compass and chart, was waiting on the shore. The tide would soon turn. His mother had been warned of his coming. Go he must. Many precious minutes were lost while he tarried, unable to tear himself away. Phyllis held to her resolve, though it cost her many a bitter pang. At last they parted, and he went down the hill. Before his footsteps had quite died away, she felt a desire to behold at least his outline once more, and running noiselessly after him regained view of his diminishing figure. For one moment she was sufficiently excited to be on the point of rushing forward, and linking her fate with his. But she could not. The courage which at the critical instant failed Cleopatra of Egypt could scarcely be expected of Phyllis Grove. A dark shape, similar to his own, joined him in the highway. It was Christoph, his friend. She could see no more. They had hastened on in the direction of the town and harbor, 4 miles ahead. With a feeling akin to despair she turned, and slowly pursued her way homeward. Tattoo sounded in the camp, but there was no camp for her now. It was as dead as the camp of the Assyrians after the passage of the destroying angel. She noiselessly entered the house, seeing nobody, and went to bed. Grief, which kept her awake at first, ultimately wrapped her in a heavy sleep. The next morning her father met her at the foot of the stairs. Apostrophe Mr. Gould has come. Apostrophe apostrophe he said triumphantly. Humphrey was staying at the inn, and had already called to inquire for her. He had brought her a present of a very handsome looking glass in a frame of repoussé silverwork, which her father held in his hand. He had promised to call again in the course of an hour, to ask Phyllis to walk with him. Pretty mirrors were rarer in country houses at that day than they are now, and the one before her won Phyllis's admiration. She looked into it, saw how heavy her eyes were, and endeavored to brighten them. She was in that wretched state of mind which leads a woman to move mechanically onward in what she conceives to be her allotted path. Mr. Humphrey had, in his undemonstrative way, been adhering all along to the old understanding. It was for her to do the same, and to say not a word of her own lapse. She put on her bonnet and tippet, and when he arrived at the hour named she was at the door awaiting him. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.